I'm Mark Labberton, president of Fuller Theological Seminary. Welcome to Conversing. What a joy it is today to welcome Dr. Otis Moss III. Reverend Moss is the senior pastor of Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago, Illinois, and he's a person of many, many parts, and I'm so delighted and honored, really, to have him as a guest today. He has been a prolific writer. He's written many different things. Just a few are titled Redemption in a Red Light District, The Gospel According to the Wiz, and Other Sermons from Cinema, The Gospel Remix, How to Reach the Hip-Hop Generation, and Preach, the Power and Purpose Behind Our Praise. He's also established more recently an enterprise called Unashamed Media, which is an opportunity to do filmmaking that is, I think, is already reaching significant audiences, but I'm sure will reach even more. So let me pause there and just say, Dr. Moss, what an honor it is. Welcome to Conversing.
Thank you. It is a delight to be here, and thank you for the invitation to have the conversation.
Well, you really are a living legacy. You are a legacy before you were born. You were on the way to being a legacy, I think, simply by the fact that you bear the full name Otis Moss III. I'd like to start really with your family and that legacy. I have known a few people who are the third, but not many. I would say less than one handful. And because of the legacy that you particularly have, I'm just eager for our audience to have a chance to know more about your story. So give us a framework for that.
Certainly. As you mentioned, my name is Otis Moss III. I am the third of those named Otis and Moss. My grandfather, who's Otis Moss Sr., was a sharecropper and a World War I veteran in LaGrange, Georgia, more specifically Troup County, Georgia. He married my grandmother, Magnolia Moss, who was a teacher who passed away early on after giving birth to five children, being a teacher. He was a sharecropper from the family history. She really taught him how to read. They were very much in love. And she died as a result of medical apartheid because she could not get the necessary healthcare assistance in Georgia during that time period because of segregation. He refused to marry again, which was very rare. Yes. Sharecropper, five children. He decided he would be a single father than to remarry.
Wow. And that decision, for example, happened about when?
That probably would have been 1939 when he made that decision. Yeah, it is quite amazing.
And what was behind that decision for him?
Well, from all the family lore that I've picked up is he loved him some Magnolia. And he did not want to have anyone simply raise his children. He would partner with the wider family in the village. And Magnolia Moss had his heart, and he just could not see marrying someone else. Again, which was a very rare thing that men usually remarried because they had children. They needed someone to take care of the children. He said, I'll be a single father. I will raise these two boys and three girls on my own. And he was a sharecropper, but he was a unique sharecropper in that he refused to work on white land. So he took the whole family and moved when he was working. He'd worked out a deal with a black family that owned land and said, look, I'll work on the land. You know, you can pay me fairly. And the person who owned the land passed away. An African-American came to supposedly buy the land. My grandfather found out that he was a front for a larger white conglomerate that was buying up black land. So he took everybody and said, we're going to leave. And they're like, where are you going to go? He said, I'm not going to be a slave. I'm not going to work for someone who's not going to treat me fairly. And eventually he found someone else in the county who still owned land that had not been bought up by this conglomerate. And that's where he lived out the rest of his days, working in that manner and making sure that my father and my aunts and uncles would be educated and would make it out of Troup County and be able to live. My aunt went to the Air Force, which paid for her to go to the University of Michigan, and she became a librarian and a voting rights activist, specifically in and around women's rights. My father went to Morehouse College and became a mentee of Dr. Benjamin Elijah Mays, and also then became close friends with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and worked in the student sit-in movement of Atlanta. My Aunt Callie, she moved to Detroit and became a voting rights activist too, but working in the school system, she was in the cafeteria. The youngest of everyone, my Uncle Mitchell, who was essentially a handyman, ended up working for the fire department, became a voting rights activist too in Detroit. And my Aunt Susie, who was the oldest, who was the first one to move, voting rights activist. All of them were committed to voting rights because of their father. And that was an ethic in the family.
Right. Amazing. What a story. So then tell us more about your father himself, because he's such a significant part of the story.
So my father, Otis Moss Jr., who I think is the greatest preacher pastor I have ever encountered in my life, went to Morehouse College, graduated in 1956, and went on to the Interdenominational Theological Center. But while he was in school in Atlanta, became involved in what was known as the student sit-in movement. The desegregation of Atlanta, along with Lonnie King and others who were a part of the movement. Another person that people may be familiar with, Marion Wright Edelman, who was at Spelman just a few years, like a year or two behind my father. They were the people who orchestrated the desegregation of Atlanta. In the process, he developed a relationship first with Martin Luther King Sr., and then developed a relationship with Martin Luther King Jr. He became a lieutenant in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference organizing and met a woman who was working as a secretary and office manager by the name of Winna Hudson, who he married. That's my mom. And so they met in the movement, and the wedding was performed by Martin Luther King Jr. Jean Young, Andrew Young's wife, was the maid of honor. Andrew Young was part of the wedding party with my father. The announcement that they were going to get married happened during the Southern Christian Leadership Conference retreat, which was in Miami. And so here's a picture, right? Rather, if you see that.
Gosh.
So the picture is literally the brain trust of the entire group. So you have Dr. King and Coretta Scott King, who threw the party for my parents. They're my parents right here. This is mom and dad.
Yes.
You got Andrew Young over here. You have Ralph Abernathy. You have the Greens. You have Hosea Williams. There's Fred Shuttlesworth in the back. You have the entire group that was doing the organizing in 1966. They threw this party for my parents. So this is the culture and the family lore in my family. And my father ended up becoming co-pastor with Martin Luther King Sr. And this is after the assassination of Dr. King at Ebenezer. And he's always remained very close with the King family. And then eventually moved to Cincinnati and then eventually Cleveland. But in Cleveland, my father's work has been just extraordinary, creating a hospital that bears his name. He's living and he has a hospital that bears his name in Cleveland because his big thing was healthcare. You know, remember, his mother died of medical apartheid. And so building a hospital that was committed in the African-American community was a lifelong dream for him. So literally across the street from the church is the Otis Moss Jr. Medical Center. He didn't want it named after him, but it was in the partnership with the hospital that they were working with. They pushed it through. They demanded that it needs to have your name. Right. And he has been a premier voting rights advocate and theologian who was also mentored by not only Benjamin Elijah Mays, but Howard Thurman. So Howard Thurman, Benjamin Elijah Mays, Dr. King. I mean, I have conversations with him often, and my mother. And when I realized that they knew certain people, like it was a couple of years ago, I found out how close they were with Fannie Lou Hamer. I'm like, you all didn't tell me this. She's like, oh yeah, she stayed at the house all the time. I'm like, really? So it's blowing me away. The fact that he's had multiple conversations with Malcolm X. He's like, oh yeah, I remember meeting Malcolm. I was like, you met Malcolm X when, Dad? Well, he was in Atlanta one time right before I graduated. We had this great conversation. And then it was at the March on Washington. He did come, but he didn't really participate. We were in the lobby of some hotel in Washington. We were talking about tactics, you know, in terms of what tactics should one use for free. I was like, really? It's like, really, dude? And one of my favorite stories that he shares is actually hilarious. I believe he was traveling back from it was from Africa. I think it was like Ghana or something of that nature, or something dealing with the SCLC. And he had to stay in Harlem because the plane was in New York, and then he had to transfer over to get back to Ohio. But so he had to stay over, I believe. And there was a young man standing outside of the hotel who was saying, come and get this autograph right now. This autograph is going to be worth so much money. You need to get this autograph. It's going to be the greatest autograph you've ever heard. And people were going up and getting the autograph. He didn't know who the young man was. He just walked past him. He saw him 6 months later standing over the body of Sonny Liston. It was Cassius Clay, who eventually became Muhammad Ali. And so he says, man, I should have got that autograph. So he is chock full of these stories. He was the one of the founding people of what was known as Operation Breadbasket, which eventually became Operation Push, Rainbow Push, and was a part of the exploratory committee when Reverend Jesse Jackson ran in 84 and 88. They've had a great relationship since that time. So he's this quiet, powerful, wonderful human being who has these relationships. So he was a part of the Camp David Accord under Jimmy Carter. He was present and there with the negotiation. Here's pictures of him sitting there in that negotiation, and then was invited again to be advisor with Clinton and then with Obama. And he's just so under the radar. He doesn't boast, will not share about it, but he has these incredible relationships and stories that he holds near and dear in his heart. Along with my mother, they are an amazing team who are deeply committed again to what I would term human flourishing, that they want to see people rise. They want to see people develop. They want to see people grow. And their spirituality and commitment to the faith is unlike I've seen anyone else.
Wow. So most people's legacies are not quite as full and rich with the history that yours is. How does that work to be a third growing up in that context and finding your own voice? Has that been a challenge or?
Oh gosh, yeah, it's a pain in the butt. You know, growing up, you're PK. The beautiful thing is my parents didn't put pressure on me. I actually enjoyed going to church. Yes. It was like a village. I enjoyed, you know, the community and the family and all that. The challenge was always trying to differentiate yourself in many ways. And I found that with the friends that I grew up in Cleveland. I found that in athletics. My father's not an athlete at all. My mom's an athlete with family. So my dad is not. And I developed athletically. I played hockey, ice hockey. I was very good, you know, and then I switched to football, basketball, and then track. Went to Morehouse on track scholarship. And I was not going to Morehouse where my father went to school. I was going to go to Case Western Reserve on whatever scholarship they wanted to give me. They said, hey, you can play football for us. You can run track. You can play basketball. We don't care. We'll put you on scholarship full 4 years. I was like, all right, I can go here. I'm good. Right. But my father did something which was hilarious and smooth. So every year, the recruiter from Morehouse would come, a gentleman by the name of Reverend Clarence, we called him. Reverend Clarence would come, and he was also a mentee of my dad's. The recruitment program was usually at a church or a hotel somewhere. They bring young men from around the Cleveland area just to talk about Morehouse and alumni. The year that I said that, oh, I'll go to, you know, Case, the recruitment program happened at our house. So the venue had to switch for whatever reason. The venue's at the house now. It's never been at the house ever. So the venue is at the house, and Reverend Clarence James is his full name. He actually lives in Chicago. Great gentleman. Begins this spiel talking about, do you want to go to school or do you want to make an impact? And he starts talking about the men who have made impacts. And he goes, he's talking about Dr. King and he's talking May. So, oh, there's Samuel L. Jackson and there's Spike Lee. And I mean, he is just leaning in. He said, and there is no other place where African-American men gather together for a positive cause. You can go to the army, maybe. You may go to prison, but there's only Morehouse that brings together these number of, I mean, by the time he finished, we were standing cheering. It was like, okay, I guess I'm going to go to Morehouse. And it was, and that's really what completely made the shift. And I mean, I had a great experience at Morehouse, but having your dad's name, and my father was a trustee in the chapel, the Martin Luther King Jr. Chapel. It's called the Hall of Men, and they have these portraits of all these amazing African-American men. So I go in there. And of course, there's a portrait of my dad. I'm like, oh my God. It's like, Lord have mercy. And so you have that weight, you know, that weight is continual. So how do you differentiate yourself becomes important in your development. And I think for every young man, when you have your father's name and you carry the weight of that legacy, making that differentiation was important. And so my intellectual pursuits, I was planning to be a filmmaker when I was in school. I wanted to be the next Spike Lee on so many levels, but I was interested in documentary film. I thought that that was the way to preach to the world, that if you merge theology along with cinematic technique, that you could reach more people than a sermon, than a ministry, because it continues to go around the globe. And we've seen that, I think, in many instances through some of the work that's being done now that has a real purpose in elevating people's mind and heart, that cinema is able to do that. It also can, you know, put you in a completely different direction, but there is the sacred elements in reference to cinema. Right. So that was kind of my interest. I was hoping to go to Union Theological Seminary and NYU. He says, hey, it's down the street. You know, it's like I could do both, but took Union forever to kind of give me, I was accepted, but I was like, I need some money. And this school called Yale, I got a letter that said, we'll pay for everything. I was like, well, I guess I'm going there. But they didn't have a film program.
Right.
But it was a great experience for me because it allowed me, again, differentiation. Here I am in New Haven. Here I am in an Ivy League. And I fell into a group called Elm City Nation that was young men who were doing gang violence prevention. And that really became a seminary training, working with these guys who were not a part of the church. And something interesting happened to me. A gentleman by the name of KV, who was notorious in New Haven for other reasons, but it turned his life around. He said to me, he said, look, I'm not coming to church, but I want you to know you need to be in the church because I need a pastor, even though I'm not coming to church. I mean, that's the way he said it. He's like, but I need a pastor. And that conversation blessed me in ways that to this day, I honor what KV and another brother who was part of the group, Scott X, you know, all of these amazing brothers who embraced me, who were really from the community, from street organizations, had a little dirt on their hands in many ways. They embraced this brother who's over at the Div School and who's from Morehouse, who's not from New Haven, who I don't have his street background, but they said understands real. And we were authentic with each other and we became really good friends. And they became in many ways my seminary professors.
So that is an amazing story. And what strikes me particularly about it is how it is a movement in your life through different worlds, each of which opens up, overlaps, intertwines, and bridges to yet other worlds where you're finding, as healthy people with opportunity can do, to be able to move from one world to another world in a way that can expand and deepen and shape both our origins as well as our immediate world and life. What an amazing thing. Did you find that in that process, what was changing in your understanding of the world through that group that you're describing? How did it reshape your grasp of what's real?
It really helped me understand systems and how systems affect people's ability to be able to flourish. You know, I kind of knew it intellectually to a degree. I'd read some, but then really seeing it up close, or someone who has a record. And Elm City Nation was functioning to really help young men who had a record. Their whole piece was economic empowerment. Like, look, you get a brother a job, it's going to change their life. And the way that Scott would lay things out, who was the director, Scott said, look, if you're selling on the corner, you may make, because there's so many different people trying to sell on the corner, you may make a $5, $10 turnaround. That's nothing. He said, the competition is too high. I mean, he said, I'm just going to use an economic analysis, he'd say. He said, but if we can get you selling some different things where there's not as much competition, you can make more money. So they were opening up stores. You know, they first started with tables on the corner selling clothes. They're going down to New York and they're getting wholesale. At the time, I think it was Cross Colors and Carl Kanai, and they're getting this stuff wholesale so they could be distributors in New Haven, but they were undercutting the other stores in the city. And so guys are making more money. It's like, off of one shirt, I can make $20, $25. When I was selling other stuff on the street, it was $5 and I'm looking over my shoulder, you know, right. When I'm selling this other stuff, you know, whatever right. It may be, that's an illegal substance. I'm not making as much money. Right. Another young man opened up you remember beepers, you know, the pagers. He opened a pager store. He said, I can make so much more. And so they were using this economic piece.
Yes.
And they were sharing that there were so many barriers to someone who had a record that we essentially want them to go back to jail. And that's when it hit me that we have a system in place that doesn't believe in redemption. And you got all these people who said, oh, I'm a Christian. I believe in second chance. I said, no, you don't. Because if you did, you would tear down the system that's in place that continues to create a cycle. And it was really extraordinary that the individuals who were pushing to be tough on crime, which was jettisoning any idea of redemption,
right,
were usually the people who in name claimed to follow Jesus. And that was an eye-opener for me.
So tell us how your image of Jesus was developing over this same arc. So you have this extraordinary family background. You have this circle of widening worlds, different angles of vision, systemic reality, not just personal reality, social reality. You have a family involved in systemic change. And how does all that unfold theologically for you? What's happening in your picture of Jesus?
Well, here's interesting. I didn't know anything about denominations and all these different kind of Americanized theological views until I went to college. So I thought there was like this black folk and there's white right. people went to church. And I thought black churches, okay, we do stuff in the community. Jesus is like going to liberate folks. You know, I mean, I just thought that that was the framework. And I go to college and then I have, you know, some friends who are conservative, like, well, you know, you're going to hell because you don't believe in this doctrine. I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, it's like, who's this guy you believe in? You know, so it was really an eye opener because I didn't know anything about evangelicalism at all. So I have some friends who joke with me and say that I'm the Ethiopian Christian among everybody. It's like I was completely encased in a completely different culture and right. It was just not Western at all. It came out of the freedom movement, the civil rights movement. So I always saw ecumenicalism. So on Anniversary Sunday, it might be Andrew Young, who is from the congregational tradition. It might be the bishop from the Pentecostal church. It might be a woman. One woman who was a big influence was named Esther Smith, who was like my father's adopted mother. And she was not allowed to be ordained, you know, when she was much younger, but she became a self-taught Old Testament scholar. So ministers from my father's seminary would go to her house so she could critique their sermons before they preached them. And she would say, have you read this? You know, have you looked at this? You really did some poor exegesis on this. That's not the translation in Hebrew in reference to this. So that, you know, I mean, she literally would critique their sermons and she would do our anniversary or the Women's Day or whatever. So the church that I grew up in was this broad and rich and celebratory community that was deeply committed to community transformation. That's what we do. Deeply committed to voting rights. Deeply committed to education and was always framed in the context of how do we live out our faith. And then I go to seminary and I'm running into people of all these different traditions and said, oh no, we've never had a woman in the pulpit. Really? But then why? You know, I'm asking in all, because I'm ignorant. It's like, well, why is that? It's like, well, yes, you know, women are not allowed. I was like, really? They can birth you, but they're not allowed. That's tough. That's pretty tough. And so there was just really some really fascinating things that I was able to encounter. But the relationships that I developed were not adversarial. I developed relationships with the person who was Southern Baptist and learned more about how the Southern Baptist engaged and developed. And it was really fascinating to me. I said, I really wanted to learn. Developed a relationship with the Unitarian and trying to understand. I said, now, what do y'all believe? What do you believe in? And then a really great relationship with someone who's from the Pan-African Orthodox Christian Church, which was connected to the Ethiopian Orthodox, but they were born out of Detroit. So it was really an interesting experience, just expanding and learning about different traditions.
I'm Mark Labberton. You're listening to Conversing, a production of Fuller Studio. So when I've listened to your preaching at Trinity, which I've often done, I've really benefited from this rich blend of communication gifts that you've been given, which have obviously frequently been noted. I'm going to come in a minute to want to explore that, especially related to preaching more. But this deep sense that you are a communicator, that you are a communicator with passion and with clarity about the thing that you want people to really understand, and that you offer both a deep pathos. I would say that's one of the best qualities of preaching, is that it actually is about pathos and pathos in action for the welfare of other people. That trajectory is at least one of the ways of describing the ministry of Jesus, but it's also one of the ways of describing your particular, and I would say, exceptional blend. When you hear that, does that capture to you what you think you're trying to do? Or would you say that you'd want to add layers to that? There's certainly much more to say, but I'm just wondering how you hear that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think that is in part what I attempt to do, and we, when I speak collectively of the church, that we attempt to do is to bring this sacred sensibility from our tradition that merges the bitter and the blessed together. Yes. And does not shy away from the tragic, but always finds the moments of triumph and hope, is very important, because I witnessed that. That was the tradition that I came from. And when I teach students, I always say, hey, listen to how Dr. King constructs his sermons. He goes through all these problems. He's like, you know, the antithesis, and then it just goes to the synthesis. Very philosophical, but he just kind of lays out these three problems, like here's the problem, here's the problem, here's the problem. But now let me get you to the triumphant moment. And we love his endings, but many times he has some of the best analysis in the first portion of his messages are extraordinary in terms of how he can make an analysis of a scripture and a problem, you know, a knock at midnight. Mm-hmm. He says, America is knocking. He said, the homeless are knocking. Those who are without food are knocking. He goes through and talks about those who've been segregated. They're knocking. So what is the answer? What is the church going to do? We have someone knocking at midnight. Will we close our doors and act as if we will not hear? But then right. He always ends out with this beautiful poetic way of sharing a vision of not yet, but functioning as if yes. It is. And that's part of the tradition that I come from. It's the Douglas tradition, who I think is probably one yes. of the greatest preachers ever. that has not been looked at. But Frederick Douglass yes. does that so well. And it's hopeful, but it just refuses to give you sugar-coated hope. And I love those Flannery O'Connor-esque grace yes. moments.
right. Well, it's interesting to hear you mention Douglas, because so often there is this exceptional way that his words still today land as though they had just been said, right? And it's because I think there's many parts to it, but one reason is exactly what you've just pointed to, which is this incredible sense of holding together both the deepest naming of the reality of pain and suffering and injustice, combined with this very deep, profound sense that there is a God who holds a reality greater than those things, and which is going to draw people toward life and hope and the good and the beautiful and the true, rather than surrendering in despair or surrendering in a false narrative about the reality of the struggle. It's an amazing combination to me.
He is, though he is, you know, been researched and things of that nature, in terms of his oratory, his rhetoric, and the theology wrapped in it, there yes. hasn't been enough done to explore the absolute brilliance of what he's able to do. It may be an hour or two when he's speaking, but what he is able
he had
to
a
do.
Long ramp.
Yeah, he really did. It was a long runway. But I mean, you're wrapped in attention. And I really wish I could have actually heard his voice, but reading the yes. fact that when he was in Scotland and he was drawing crowds of 10,000 people, and in Ireland, you know, 10,000 people, and he connected the Irish and Scottish history to the struggle of African Americans, and they built a statue for him over there to say that yeah. no, this is the kind of person we want to be like, you know, that yes. he was beloved. He was beloved yes. in, you know, outside of the U.S., they wanted to assassinate him in the U.S., but he was really beloved. He knew how to communicate in ways that a lot of people could learn a lot from Frederick Douglass.
Right. So in everybody's story, there's this tension that we've just described between suffering and pain of some kind and something else that hopefully is the source of hope and life to them. In your case, I want to sort of zero in on one part of your story that I've just been very moved by. You've spoken about it and you've written about it, and that is the tragic suicidal death of your sister, Daphne. Daphne had been diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic. You had been deeply affected by this as a young boy. Just tell us a bit about that story and about her death.
Certainly. She died in 94. We were very close when I was small. She was 9 years my senior. I mean, I thought she could literally walk on water. I love my sister because she gave me space and time, and she loved on her little brother. She took me to the movies Friday night, took me to Baskin Robbins. You know, we had chocolate chip ice cream. I had Baskin Robbins on Friday night. There was a movie, and she's like, you know, come on, you're my date tonight. That's how she operated. I was introduced to jazz through her. My first jazz concert, she took me to see Wynton Marsalis. And the only reason I knew about Wynton Marsalis, I went to, they have these things called libraries that some people may not know about, where you check out stuff. You used to be able to check out, they're called records. They look like giant CDs, and there's no streaming back then. So I got this record, and it was his first record that he produced. He's probably like, at the time, maybe 19 or 20, 21 or something of that nature. And my sister took me when he came to Cleveland to hear him, and I was absolutely, you know, enthralled by his music. And here was this super young guy who was playing jazz and classical. She introduced me to Black Lit. She was an extraordinary intellect, extraordinary writer. My sister had read all of Baldwin, Zora Neale Hurston, Nikki Giovanni, Maya Angelou. She'd read all the Harlem Renaissance writers. That was her thing. And she kept these journals where she would write prose and her poetry. And she would read me some of it from time to time. But she would read me stories before I went to bed. And at the time, I didn't like many of them. But I didn't realize the story she was reading. So she's reading me sections of James Baldwin. Right. She's reading me sections of Zora Neale Hurston. She's reading me sections of Maya Angelou. When I get to college, I realize that when we're assigned something, I was like, I know this. Oh, my. And it clicked. My sister had been feeding me all of this great literature. And then it doesn't click until I go to college. So I developed this real love for literature and for especially poetry at a young age because of her. She goes to Spelman College. She has some challenges. She eventually graduated. And there were several times where she had episodes as she was getting older. She would have these episodes. So it took her a while to graduate, but she eventually graduated. She went on and got her master's from Kent State. And she specialized in teaching children who were differently abled, who had learning disabilities, was a tremendous teacher, but she was also a model. So my sister was, she's beautiful. I mean, just absolutely just cover model gorgeous. And she was a runway model also. Prior to, I was about a week, no, about 4 days, before I was to get married, she committed suicide. And that was one of the most difficult times in my life. You know, I'm gonna have to get married and I've got to go bury my sister. And my parents were real clear. They were just like, nope, you're not postponing the wedding. We had this big family meeting with Monica's family, and you know, we're going to have the wedding. We'll be here. And then, you know, we'll do the homegoing later. And it took me years really to process because I just buried it. I didn't want to talk about it. I couldn't even say that my sister committed suicide. People would ask me, you know, do you have any siblings? I say, oh yeah, I've got an older brother. I've got, I have a sister. And I would say, she passed away. And then I started saying, oh, she had a terminal illness. I could never utter the words. And so it took me some time to be able to utter the words. And it actually happened. The first time I publicly said something was from the pulpit in Augusta, Georgia, where I was pastoring at the time. And it was not written in my sermon at all, that I just mentioned it. And I realized, I was like, oh my God, I think I almost cussed in my head. I just said it. And I started getting letters from people saying, thank you. because, you know, my daughter has experienced this, my son, my brother, my sister, my mother. And that really started my journey of coming to grips with her suicide and her paranoid schizophrenia. And I eventually wrote an article for Ebony Magazine about my sister.
Lucy Daphne.
That's right. And I wrote that article. We were in Chicago at the time. And there was a sister who was working with Ebony at the time, who was just really wonderful in terms of publishing that. For a year straight, I got a letter every week from somebody around the country. For a year straight, about saying, thank you. My daughter is having mental health issues. We never could talk about it. Thank you. My father, I never could talk about the fact that my father committed suicide. I mean, it was a year straight where it was just like every week. I was like, there's a letter. And then I get a little emotional thinking about something happened that was truly the Holy Spirit and the cloud of witnesses my sister now is a part of. I firmly believe orchestrated. I got this letter. We got this letter, my wife, Monica, and I, we got this letter. And we thought that somebody was trying to scam us, saying, contact us. You know, we have some money. I'm like, oh gosh, it's like, this is a scammer. You know, it's a scammer. Right. It was an assumption. It was a scammer. And we kept getting the letter. So I called my parents and they didn't know anything about it. And so we then took this, I was like, is this a legit company? So I contact and they say, your name is Otis Moss III. I said, yeah. I said, well, we've been looking for you for the last several years. Your sister had placed that to her retirement was to go to you. We've been looking for you. And the exact amount of the retirement paid for our son's education. So I was like, what? Because we were like, should we send him to private school? You know, he's like, here comes this check that pays his tuition. And we were like, well, I guess Daphne said, yeah, send him to private school. So, I mean, it was really, when you talk about God winking, you know, that was really the act of the Holy Spirit, just winking at myself and Monica and saying that because you shared the truth in your weakness, I will make you strong. And show strength when you're showing you're at your most vulnerable. And that's what being able to share that story. But I mean, it was years to be able to share it. And then, you know, I go and do the Beecher lectures I've already. And a part of that whole Blue Note piece is connected to the song of my sister, yes. Which became a psalm in many ways in my heart.
Right. One of the things that in the Beecher lectures, which I would just really encourage people to find and read, you can get a copy of this because they were published. Those lectures were entitled The Blue Note Gospel, Preaching the Prophetic Blues in a Post-Soul World. They're remarkable lectures in many ways, and they certainly move, I would say, the Beecher lectures in a very fresh and different direction than I would call the classic lectures, which, while they are very moving and important in their own distinct way, your voice stands out because of the Blue Note theme. It stands out because of the jazz theme. It stands out because of the Black theme. It stands out because of the depth of the story of anguish and suffering alongside the affirmation of hope, which is this combination again and again that, to me, is so life-giving. Do you want to make any comment about what that experience was like to be, as it were, anointed into this role? Because it really is a very honorific thing to do, especially at a young age.
It was absolutely nerve-wracking. So I was I was like completely a mess. You get the invitation, you know, like well over a year in advance. And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, it's like, what am I going to say? So I went and looked at what Dr. Gardner C. Taylor did and what was his preparation process. He went and got all the Beecher lectures and started reading them and whatnot. And, you know, he was not too far from New Haven. He could take a train up to New Haven. So I started doing the same thing. And so I said I was going to try and find as many as I could, read through those and just get a sense of what is this about? What are people doing? What are they sharing? And it became very clear that in order to present something, I didn't want to present what had been presented. The only thing I could do is just present what I was rooted in, not only what I knew about, but what I was going to, you know, it's going to be fun kind of researching.
Yes.
And so the Blue Note theme, which was really had been already a theme in my life, became the topic for the lecture, the 3 days. And it was a lot of fun. It really was. After I got through it, I was just, oh, praise the Lord. glad we're done. but it really was a real privilege, and it was a lot of fun to be able to do and to weave all the different influences, as you mentioned, to look at jazz as not only just music, but a thematic and theological framework, to incorporate August Wilson next to James Cone, to incorporate, you know, Ralph Ellison in terms of understanding scripture along with Gerrit von Rad, you know, just bringing all of these elements together and saying that there is a different way. There is a tradition. There is a tradition that has been much older than everybody in this room that has been examining how to communicate. And in that oral communication, there is a depth of theology and spirituality that we are still mining to this day to completely understand the complexity of it. And that was really the project, was to delve into that cultural matrix that comes out of the African-American tradition and how it truly reshapes preaching and is deeply connected to a very ancient tradition that utilized the same matrix in many ways to communicate the word.
If I was to ask you to preach three sermons in this moment, and you were to take a hold of what you think are three of the most critical biblical texts or three of the most critical issues that you were going to be preaching about, what would those three be? Just give us a sense of the heartbeat of where you feel the greatest burden, the greatest hope, the greatest need, however it is that you might define it.
I think that there'd have to be an exploration of Job, of learning how to embrace the suffering and understanding the other side of, yet though he slay me, yet will I trust him. So there is a facing of suffering that we just don't want to explore. And that title actually is from a book, I think Michelle Horde actually recently wrote, which just has kind of made sense in the references moment. So the poetry of Job and seeing it poetically is important, because we deal in a laboratory way of like, oh, here is the text. No. The poetry of Job, because the fact that you're writing poetry in the midst of suffering is also saying that every word that you're placing or every word you utter, there's hope in the breath. And we miss. Right. We miss. So I think that that would be important.
Yes.
We then would have to engage the prophets. Probably Jonah is probably the one more than anything else. And I recently heard one of the professors at Mercer, McAfee School of Theology, was talking about that we need to see the sailors as the prophets who are asking the question to Jonah, who are you? So they're asking the prophetic questions that we need to ask. Who is your God? Why has this happened? And the inquiry of, we need to inquire about this storm and what are we running from as a nation that keeps getting us into storms because we refuse to speak truth in spaces like Nineveh that nobody wants to be a part of. And then finally, I think it's the Gospels, when Jesus gives this indication in Matthew of the fact that, you know, what you do to the least of these. I think it was Vernon Johns, who was the precursor to Dr. King at Dexter Avenue, who took that text and was raising the question of what type of church shall we build? Will the church be built on those things that give us pleasure, or will the church be built on those things that bring God joy and alleviate suffering? You know, what you do to the least of these. And then raising the question, who are the least of these? And what ministry have we developed? And that is just such a clear edict, and where you really have Jesus kind of getting ticked off and saying, hey, I'm going to separate some folks in reference to this. And we don't have enough ministries raising that question. And we think that it's a church denominational building idea when it's really this soul idea, you know, that what will we do? Because Jesus doesn't ask the question, you know, hey, are you going to go to somebody and say, am I your personal savior? No, he does say, what will you do for the least of these? And the ancient form of practice in the faith And I learned this when I went to Ethiopia, where they do not have any form of evangelism. They say that, no, we don't tell anybody that they have to be an Ethiopian Orthodox. Our belief is that God came into the world to show us how to dance. We made the decision early on that we would rather taste from this tree than dance with you. And they view the brokenness of the world from that perspective. But then they say, Jesus comes back to say, can I show you how to dance again? And in that tradition, you choose to dance with God. And if you dance with God, you beautify the world. And when you dance with God, some people may join you in the dance. But even if they don't, the dance is so powerful that it still blesses people who choose not to dance. So you don't get caught into who's dancing and not dancing. Your job is just to keep on dancing. In the process, it beautifies and spreads the love and just action of God through your actions. It's so un-American, but it's so richly gospel and out of our tradition. And it's something that we can't yet embrace because we want numbers and we want to know who converted and at what time and all of these things. And the Ethiopian tradition, which is older than anything in America, it's the oldest. They just say, look, we pray three times a day, we fast, and we believe in dancing with God. And in the process, if you watch us long enough, you might join. If you don't, it doesn't make a difference because it's still going to be beautiful by what we do. And you're going to be blessed in the process of what we do. And I think that that is, in this moment, we've got to learn how to dance.
Right, right. Yeah, there's far too little dancing. I agree. It's been mechanized. It's part of the ecclesiastical industrial complex of churches, business, churches, organization, churches as a management opportunity, church as...
I'm going to quote you. I'm going to use that in a sermon. As the doc said, the ecclesiastical industrial complex. I'm going to put it right up there next to that most Christianity is capitalism in ecclesiastical garments.
Indeed. The two have a lot to do with each other. Dr. Moss, this has been such a gift. I could go on having this conversation for hours, but I know we're coming to an end. So I just want to pause and say thank you. I am personally grateful for your witness to me. When I have the opportunity to listen to services that are happening at Trinity, I'm just deeply moved by the whole of the service, but also especially by your preaching. I feel like I've heard the gospel through you in so many important ways for me. And I want to continue hearing and learning the gospel, especially from people whose lives are very different than my own, very different than the culture and context in which I was raised, but who, because of the gospel, has opened up reality to me. And that reality has to include and see and internalize and trust the narrative of people's stories that are not my own. And you are certainly one of those people that do that for me personally, and I know for many, many, many people in so many different places. So thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. This has been a real honor. And we thank you for your leadership at Fuller and for the work that you're doing. We need your leadership and your voice and for all the students who are doing work at Fuller. We are just real appreciative.
God bless you. Thank you. You've been listening to a production of Fuller Studio. Fuller Studio provides articles, podcasts, videos, and other resources for a deeply formed spiritual life. Subscribe on your favorite podcast app or visit us at fuller.edu/studio.